This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals only. Welcome to the Oncology Knowledge into Practice podcast, where we discuss game-changing topics in clinical oncology with leading experts in the field. In this series, we're focusing on the ever-changing treatment landscape for cancers of the hematological system. This series is supported by educational grants from Servier Pharmaceuticals LLC and Takeda, who have had no influence on the content or choice of faculty. If you'd like to check out any of the publications that we mention in this episode, there's references and links for these in the episode notes. We're your hosts, Hannah Wilgar
and Andre Grasa. In our last episode, we discussed highlights from the ASCO and EHA conferences with Dr. Dieter Holzer and Dr. Amer Zeidan. Today, we'll speak with our final expert, Dr. Naval Daver, to see what his highlights were.
So welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Daver.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So I know you weren't able to join us for our last episode about the ASCO and EHA highlights, but I'm glad to have this opportunity to still discuss your highlights with you. So thinking first about MDS, was there a particular highlight for you from either the ASCO or EHA conferences or both?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to discuss the AML-MDS highlights from ASCO and EHA. For MDS specifically, we had a few new updates and novel drugs that were presented. The three that I think are very exciting at this time based on the data presented are venetoclax, especially in combination with hypomethylating agent in frontline higher-risk MDS. There was updated data presented on this by Dr. Andrew Wei from Australia showing very promising responses. Also, there was updated data presented with sabatolimab in combination with azacitidine. Sabatolimab is a TIM-3 antibody that has shown good activity and safety when combined with azacitidine. And the data shown at the EHA focused especially on high-risk patients, those with TP53 mutations and adverse cytogenetics, showing that this combination appeared to maintain and maybe even have higher efficacy in those higher risk population, which remain one of significant unmet need. And the third drug that was presented at the EHA ASCO was pevonedostat. This is a NED8 inhibitor in combination with azacitidine, also completing a randomized phase 3 study that we hope to hear the results in late 2021. And the drug appears to be extremely safe and also showing very encouraging complete remission rates. And a fourth drug that was not presented at EHA ASCO, but they were very excited about in MDS, is a drug called magrolimab, another immune therapy approach that works by activating macrophages through interrupting the CD47 SIRP alpha pathway that suppresses macrophage activity. So all in all, a lot of exciting updates and a lot happening in frontline MDS, you know, compared to 5 years ago when there was really nothing on the horizon for frontline MDS. We're looking at now potentially four drugs that hopefully could all get approved and then used in various combinations and sequences to really improve the response and the survival for our MDS patients.
Great. So with those four drugs that you mentioned, what do you think the timelines are? How soon can we expect to see one or, you know, even four new drugs in MDS?
Yes, all of them have actually now started randomized phase 3 studies. The two that are probably potentially the earliest, at least to be submitted to the US FDA, are pevonedostat and magrolimab. Pevonedostat has completed a large phase 3 randomized multinational placebo-controlled study called the PANTHER study, and that one completed enrollment in end of 2020, and we are expecting the events to read out somewhere in the August-September timeframe. So we all are waiting eagerly to see what those show, because if that is positive, the phase 3, then we hope to see approval early next year, potentially for pevonedostat. And the other drug is magrolimab, which has also now started a phase 3 study called ENHANCE study, but in fact will be filing based on their extended large phase 2 of about 100 patients. And that filing will also be happening later this year. So potentially, depending on the discussions and review of the FDA, also magrolimab could have approval early next year. So at least those two look like maybe even in early 2020, if things go well, could get approved and be on the market soon after. Venetoclax and sabatolimab are currently undergoing their randomized phase 3 studies, so may take a little bit longer, but hopefully by end of 2022 to early 23, we'll see some of the data from those. So within the next, I would say 2 years to 2.5 years, there's a high probability that we will see approvals of hopefully many or all of these drugs.
Wow, that is very exciting. So thinking about the venetoclax trial that you mentioned, how can this change? So it's a phase 1b trial at the moment, isn't it, that was released?
Right.
How do you see it potentially changing clinical practice if it does get to the approval stage?
Absolutely. Venetoclax is a very, very effective drug. Initially started development in CLL, chronic lymphoid leukemia. Then we started finding activity for it in acute myeloid leukemia. Investigators at MD Anderson, including myself and our group, Dr. DiNardo, Konopleva, and others have been working on venetoclax in various combinations. And it's quite a fantastic drug showing activity in acute myeloid leukemia in frontline setting where it's already approved, the combination of azacitidine or decitabine with venetoclax, but also in combination with targeted therapies. There was a lot of exciting data shown this year at EHA combining venetoclax with IDH inhibitor, ivosidenib, FLT3 inhibitor, gilteritinib. We're combining it with immune therapies like magrolimab and PD-1 inhibitors and with drugs like pevonedostat. So this really seems to be a drug that could work across heme malignancies. And so the next logical step was to evaluate it, of course, in myelodysplastic syndrome, especially the higher risk myelodysplastic syndrome that often have higher blast and kind of behave like AML phenotype as well as biology. So the study that was updated and presented at the EHA by Dr. Andrew Wei, colleague and friend of mine from Australia, showed very high response rates. They treated a total of about 80 patients, and they showed that the overall response rate was 80%, which is quite fantastic given that with single agent azacitidine, the expected overall response rate is about 35%. And even more impressively was that the true CR rate, meaning achievement of full count recovery maintained for a certain period of time, along with bone marrow blast less than 5%, was 40%. And with azacitidine alone, historically, that has been about 15 to 20%. So this looks like a very, very effective drug, basically doubling the overall response rate and the true CR rate, appears to be well tolerated. It is important to note that in the MDS, the dosing is different from AML. In AML, we do continuous daily venetoclax, still the end of cycle one marrow, which is around day 21 through 28. On the other hand, in MDS, because of some initial experiences in the phase one where we saw significant myelosuppression, the dosing is now reduced to only 14 days. So with that 14 days venetoclax with azacitidine appears to be very safe, low early mortality, infection rates were well manageable and very high responses. And they also showed for the first time the updated survival with now a very good mature median follow-up of about 24 months and showing that the median survival at this time was close to about 28 to 30 months, so, which looks very, very promising given that with azacitidine alone, we usually see something in the range of 18 to 20 months based on most presented and published data sets. So again, for approval, the Verona phase 3 study is ongoing. I think if venetoclax is approved, given that a lot of community physicians are already familiar with using it in the frontline AML space, I think there will be a very rapid uptake and use of venetoclax in the frontline MDS.
Great, thank you. That's very exciting. You mentioned safety in that trial. I noted there was, what was it? I think it was 55% dose interruptions. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of standard for venetoclax? Is it something that you see as being an important part of managing patients on these therapies?
Yes, I think venetoclax is very unique in the way it works. So basically, unlike targeted therapy that will attach to a particular receptor and suppress the growth of a particular cell, venetoclax usually is working through the apoptotic machinery. So it's really causing a apoptosis of the cells. And the way it does this is by blocking BCL2. So BCL2 is an anti-apoptotic protein, and cancer cells, being intelligent, are able to upregulate BCL2 to protect themselves from apoptosis. And so venetoclax then goes and blocks BCL2, and by removing that anti-apoptotic protective machinery, allows apoptosis to occur normally as it should in healthy human cells. So the point there really is that once you cross the apoptotic threshold, so once you have sufficient priming of the cells, usually we see that apoptosis occurs rapidly and continues for a long time. So you don't need continuous venetoclax suppression of the receptors on board, unlike with FLT3 or IDH inhibitors. And so it's quite common that we will interrupt venetoclax in patients who are achieving bone marrow clearance remission, but may not yet be recovering counts, because the most common toxicity with venetoclax is neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. And so unlike the targeted therapies, there is a little bit of nuance and art to management of venetoclax, where you need to give it time in some cases to let count recovery occur. And it cannot just be often given in continuous cycles like with some of the other targeted therapies. But in the end, if used with experience and with knowledge of how the apoptotic pathway works, it's quite effective.
Right. It sounds quite similar to some other therapies that that we've spoken about in other episodes, like immune inhibitors. They require quite a lot of management, but
yes,
but it's worth right, it. Right.
Expertise and yeah, exactly, knowing the kinetics of responses. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So that all sounds really exciting for MDS. What about AML? What would you say were your conference highlights for AML patients?
For acute myeloid leukemia at EHA and ASCO, there was not as much data actually as in myelodysplastic syndrome. There were updates of ongoing studies, frontline studies. There was an update of the salvage study of gilteritinib in relapse refractory FLT3 AML. So this was the ADMIRAL study that led to the approval of gilteritinib in relapse refractory FLT3 mutated AML. And Dr. Pearl from UPenn presented an updated survival showing basically that patients who had received gilteritinib continued to have an improved survival as compared to standard intensive chemotherapy or low intensity therapy in relapse refractory FLT3, basically confirming the high importance and value of using FLT3 inhibitors in all FLT3 mutated relapsed AML populations. And also he showed that transplant seemed to have a significant favorable impact, especially in gilteritinib-treated relapsed FLT3 mutated patients who could achieve remission. So the goal really should be to use a FLT3 inhibitor and transition people to transplant, and potentially now even using post-transplant FLT3 inhibitors. Other data sets looked at combinations of venetoclax with targeted therapies, and there were two of those presented. One was venetoclax with IDH1 inhibitor, ivosidenib. Dr. Lakovitz from our group at MD Anderson presented the updated data showing very high response rates in excess of 80% in relapse refractory IDH mutated AML, which is about double of the 35-40% response rate that has been published and shown with IDH inhibitor single agent. So again, combining venetoclax, showing a very high degree of synergy and activity, and the MRD negativity rates especially seem to be very, very encouraging. And also another combination that looked at gilteritinib, potent second generation FLT3 inhibitor, which is approved as a single agent relapse FLT3. We now are looking at that in combination with venetoclax, again showing very encouraging and potent activity.
Okay, great. So with the venetoclax gilteritinib combination that was in relapsed and refractory patients, was there any sort of correlation that you saw at this stage with the kinds of prior therapies that the patients had had?
That's a great question. So the venetoclax gilteritinib study is a multi-center study in the US looking at relapse refractory FLT3, ITD and or TKD mutated AML patients. And overall, the study showed a very high response rate, about 80% modified CRC. Basically, when we compare this to ADMIRAL, the modified CRC response rate was 52%. So very encouraging and nice improvement. And even more important, now we're moving away from the CRC-CR responses to more FLT3 PCR high sensitivity MRD clearance. And what we could see was when we compared the minimal residual disease clearance with the venetoclax gilteritinib using a very high sensitivity 10 raised to minus 5 assay, we see that almost 60% of the responders had cleared the FLT3 PCR at lower than 10 raised to minus 2 minus 3, compared to only about 20% who would achieve that level of clearance with gilteritinib alone. So really does look much more powerful, not only for achieving a marrow clearance and remission, which is required to get to transplant, but also for achieving a deep molecular clearance and remission, at least at the level of 10 raised to minus 3 and lower. Now, one of the important questions that's coming up in the FLT3 community is, what is the impact of gilteritinib alone or venetoclax gilteritinib in the relapse in patients who have had a prior FLT3 inhibitor with induction? because with the approval of midostaurin about 3 years ago, almost all frontline FLT3 mutated AML patients in the United States and Europe are now receiving intensive chemo with midostaurin. And so there was limited data to say what happens when those people relapse. Are they going to do as well with gilteritinib, or will they not do as well because they already got midostaurin induction? So we looked at that. And since this study, the venetoclax gilteritinib study, was done more recently in the last 3 years, a majority of our patients, about 65% of our patients, had received a prior FLT3 inhibitor, either midostaurin or sorafenib with induction. And what we found was very interesting, that in spite of having received a prior FLT3 inhibitor, there was a maintained 80% response rate. So it really didn't matter when you use venetoclax and gilteritinib, whether you had had a prior FLT3 inhibitor with your induction or not, the combination was so powerful that it overcame any effect of the prior FLT3 inhibitor. And this was really encouraging, because with gilteritinib alone, we don't see the same thing. We see that people who've had prior FLT3 inhibitor like midostaurin induction, yes, they still do better with gilteritinib in relapse than with chemo, but the response rate is a little bit lower, about 35-40%, and the survival is a little bit lower. But with venetoclax gilteritinib, that did not seem to be the case. So I think even more powerful rationale to use this combination in the current era, where almost all the frontline patients will have received midostaurin with the induction.
Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing with us your highlights.
All right, thank you very much.
So that brings us to the end of today's episode. To recap on the key points we discussed, several novel agents are in the pipeline for MDS patients, including venetoclax, in combination with azacitidine, which will require monitoring and management if approved. While for AML, venetoclax plus gilteritinib is showing promise in early phase studies in relapse and refractory FLT3 mutated patients. Again, if you'd like to check out any of the publications that we've mentioned today, you'll find references for these in the episode notes.
So that concludes this hemato-oncology series. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back in the near future with more educational oncology content. So if you enjoyed this series, please do subscribe and join us then. And if you have time to leave us a review, we'd love to hear your feedback. If you want more, you can also find free accredited continuing medical education resources on our website, onkip.com. And you can find a link to this in the episode notes, so please do check it out. If you're a Twitter fan, our handle is @onkip. Thank you for listening. We'll see you soon.